Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, last week saw yet another far-right government ascend the world stage. Whether neo-crypto or proto-fascist, Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro represents a further ebbing of Latin America's so-called pink tide movement. The bitter fruits of this social change can be seen on the faces of the thousands fleeing Central America, desperate to escape the counter-revolution regimes put in place, ironically enough, through the agency of El Norte countries like ours, Canada. Eve Engler is a Montreal-based activist, essayist, and author. His articles appear at Dissident Voice, the Palestine Chronicle, and Pacific Free Press, among other places. The latest of his 10 books, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, is freshly off the presses and questions why, despite all evidence to the contrary, Canadians still suffer under the delusion that they and their nation's government are a benevolent force in the world. Eve will be at UVic tonight at 7 p.m. in the Hickman Building for a presentation on and book launch of Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Eve Engler in the first half. And once a haven for pirates, privateers, copra plantations, and hewn coral fortresses, the Caribbean's sun-baked sands and turquoise seas, plied by Spanish galleons loaded with silver and golden pieces of eight, has long occupied a gloried place in the imagination of winter-bound Westerners as where any man with a buccaneering spirit and sturdy cutlass could carve out his fortune. Surprisingly, all these centuries later, the dream remains. Only the dreamers have changed. Jeb Brague is a former journalist, author, and a visiting faculty member in sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Jeb Sprague and the New Pirates of the Caribbean in the second half. And Victoria-based activist and CFUV radio broadcaster at large, Janine Bancroft, will be here at the bottom of the hour with the Left Coast Events Bulletin of some of the good things to do in and around our town in the coming week. But first, Eve Engler and Marching to the Imperial Beat. Stick around. Well, welcome back to the program, Eve.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Eve, as I mentioned, you're in town tonight and through the weekend for a couple of events. Now, firstly, Eve, what can we expect tonight at your 7 p.m. UVic presentation?
It's just going to be an overview of the book, and it'll probably be a 45, 50-minute presentations overview of the book, and then people can ask questions, make comments, criticize what I've said.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as always, and as I said, in the intro there, Canadians are surprised. I blame the media, but I mean, is there something else do you feel at play here that we Canadians, this image of us as this sterling force in the world and ever the white hats?
Yeah, I mean, the media is the dominant explanation, the corporate media being very much biased in favor of power, very much unwilling to challenge what is being told to us from Global Affairs Canada, what's being told to us from the mining companies or whatnot, the agents of Canadian foreign policy, but or the military for that matter. I don't think it is just the media, and that's what my last book looked into. There's different academic institutions that deal with foreign policy that are very much, set up. Most infamous case, the Monk Center of Global Affairs, being set up by the founder of Barrick Gold, the largest gold mining company, Peter Monk, and has had all kinds of influence over the direction of this very influential academic institution. And you got huge PR department of the Canadian military, which, is the biggest public relations entity in the country, the Canadian military. The latest book goes into looking at looks at the 10% of the question of why we're so confused about Canada's role in the world. The 90% of that question I try to answer in my previous book, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. This latest book looks at the 10%, and that's that the left, the main left institutions, left commentators have very much gone along with the official narrative of Canadian foreign policy, and it looks at, importantly, the NDP and CCF, the social, main social democratic party in the country, and how there's just a long history of the NDP and CCF supporting, justifying unjust Canadian foreign policy decisions. There's innumerable examples, but you know, the NDP voted for both House of Commons votes in favor of bombing Libya in 2011, even though that was clearly broke the UN resolution. It's been a total catastrophe for Libyans and for many Africans in the Sahel region of Africa. Similarly, labor unions have for the large part, not really challenged the official narrative of Canadian foreign policy. So the book looks at basically these other the left-wing forces and how they've conceded, and that explains a chunk of why the public is so more than 90% of Canadians think this country is a benevolent force. Well, if there's no one saying that it's not, why would people believe differently?
Yeah. Well, and from outside the country too, especially in the U.S., there's a perception of Canada as this social democracy, this lefty kind of place, and that fits into the narrative that we tell ourselves. Nobody, in my mind at least, emblemizes that better than the NDP. You know, I come from an NDP household, and they really represent that idea that we are good, and then don't really follow through. It's just rhetoric, or it's an assumption that we allow others to place on us without actually following through on. Eve, has the NDP ever apologized or said, oh, maybe we weren't right to back the destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi, given what's happened in the interim years?
Not as far as I know. No. I don't know. And as I quote in the book, you have Jack Layton saying before, or as the bombing is about to start, that we need to do it. And you have Nicole Tournel, who was the interim leader immediately after Gaddafi was killed, celebrating Canada's role in the killing, celebrating Canadian troops. But no, there has been no recognition that, as far as I know, that the African Union was vehemently opposed to the NATO bombing. And then they said that, well, what's going to happen here? What's going to be the aftermath of this? This is going to lead to all kinds of destabilization. Uh-huh. That's what African Union officials were saying. That's obviously what happened. During the campaign for head of the party, I brought up at a private event, I brought up with Nikki Ashton, who was one of the candidates, the most left-wing candidates running for the head of the party, I brought up the question of her voting or not voting in favor of bombing Libya in 2011, and she basically said she didn't remember if she participated in the vote or not. Because a couple of MPs tried to stay away from the House of Commons and just didn't want to. The party was had been whipped in favor of voting, yes, but a few of them apparently just tried to not be there so they didn't have to vote in favor. The fact that she couldn't remember whether she voted one way or not, and yet this vote and the bombing campaign had such a massive consequence on so many people's lives, I think is reflective of the fact that the party has to a large extent never really been challenged on what they did with regards to Libya.
Well, did you check the Hansard to see if she had voted one way or the other, or was playing hooky?
I didn't actually take the time to check the Hansard. Maybe I should have, but I didn't.
Well, it speaks volumes. I mean, and for people over here that don't understand, you know, we get this image again through the media of individual strongman leaders. You know, Muammar Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein or Assad in Syria. And that's supposed to justify everything, like, oh, he's a monster, a murderer, et cetera, and a lot of stories that are later proven to be outright fabrications, but the media doesn't correct itself or apologize for a misleading or anything like that after the fact that I can recall. But the importance of what happened in Libya, if you see these streams of African migrants desperate to get across the Mediterranean into Europe, a lot of that you can trace right back to Libya. Muammar Gaddafi was a great benefactor for sub-Saharan Africa, and once he was removed, that beneficence ended, and these people, desperate already, became absolutely impelled to find relief somewhere.
For sure. I mean, there's a There is an absolutely important need. I think part of even combating some of the rise of the far right is to not just look at foreign policy questions from how they, you know, it's wrong to support bombing a country that in contravention of international law and whatnot, but also to look at the world from a bigger place, and that these, you know, there's a connection between refugees fleeing and, you know, Canadian policy in pushing exploitation. There's a connection between our climate pollution and destabilization in other places. There's a connection between, in the case of Honduras, you know, the 2009 coup, where Canada supported the coup very clearly. Canadian mining companies supported the coup, and the caravan of refugees fleeing Honduras and Central America. Now there's a connection between these different foreign policy decisions in the interests of a fairly narrow sector of Canadian political life, destabilizations, and I think even going further into looking at some of, you know, the rise of Islamophobia, and you know, this is connected, partly connected to, us going to war with Afghanistan and needing a whole line of like anti-Muslim kind of arguments to justify that and pumping that into Canadian political culture, and you lead to people being more and more scared of Muslims and stuff like that if that's what the military is pushing out. Or conversely, or alongside that, you know, there's a component of the whole pro-Israel culture that's tied to demonizing Arabs and demonizing Muslims, and that also gets into our political life, and people get attracted by it, or scared by it, or confused by it, or whatever. So I think that we do need to definitely at this point need to be looking at these foreign policy questions and how they have sort of direct impact on. It's not just something far away over there, but there's an impact on Canadian political culture.
Well, yeah. Well, in the Arab world, Canada has played an active part in military action against Iraq, against Libya, against Syria. We also have supported nefarious forces in Palestine that have made life for the Palestinians living under occupation there more difficult. So if maybe we have a reason to be afraid of the Arab world after all.
Yeah, I mean, certainly many Arabs would have a legitimate grievance against Canada, and those are things that are that are just lost in the mix of how Iraq has been basically bombed for almost 30 years now, and Canada hasn't been obviously at the center of that, like the U.S. has, or Britain has, not quite at the center, but has been part of that. You know, it was part of the early 90s bombing. It was part of bombing in 1998 and other periods through the 90s. Didn't do official contribution to the coalition willing in 2003, but provided all kinds of less known forms of support to the U.S.-led 2003 invasion of Iraq. And then, in recent times, it's still there. There's hundreds of Canadian special forces in Iraq. Canada was providing all kinds of different military support. It has been doing that for, I guess it's almost 4 years now. And these policies, they mean something to most people in the world. And there's basically, one of the points I bring out in this book, there's almost... I think one of the principles of a just Canadian foreign policy should be the idea of doing no harm, putting that first, do no harm, right? From like the medical world of thinking through, well, if we do this, is this going to lead to some harm? We might think this is a good thing. We might look at, but what's going to be the, and our political culture is completely interventionist, is completely do more with regards to Canadian foreign policy across the board, from the NGO world, want more aid, to the sort of liberal kind of peacekeeping responsibility to protect crowd who want, you know, more peacekeeping interventions, and to the sort of more hard right militarists who just want to bomb, bomb, bomb. Everyone is saying the world needs more Canada. But I think that there's a good argument to be made that the world needs less Canada in international affairs, and we should be looking at these foreign policy decisions through this lens of, you know, is there going to be a harm that we might think this is, you know, a positive thing, but what's going to be the outcome? What's going to be the likely result? And that's a real uphill battle to do that, because again, the political culture is very much in favor of more Canada, but doesn't tend to remember or connect the dots between some of the outcomes or the effects of these policies and what they mean 2, 3, 4, 5 years later for people's lives elsewhere.
Well, yes, it's unconscionable, too. I mean, if you look at Iraq, the state of Iraq today, and the state of Syria, and the state of Libya, in Canada have contributed, at least our government and those that support it, have contributed in the, you know, making their cities look like bleached coral reefs, you know. I mean, and the misery and the displacement and, you know, everything that goes with war, we have brought to them. And then we can say, yeah, but you don't have Saddam Hussein anymore, so you're better off. Or, hey, but we got rid of that Gaddafi guy for you, or almost sad. But if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eve Angler. Eve is a Montreal-based activist. He's an essayist and he's an author. He's going to be up here at UVic tonight at 7 p.m. in the Hickman Building for a presentation on his latest book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Eve, I haven't read this book yet, but I read your last one, A Propaganda System, How Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. You mentioned it earlier, and you mentioned too in that book that the huge role that the Canadian Forces plays in PR in this country, something that I wasn't aware of at all. And you said today that they were the biggest PR outfit going in Canada. Do you think then that they are bigger even than the CBC?
Well, I define the CBC in a different way. I define the CBC as part of the media, and media does have a, you know, plays a propagandistic role, but it's a slightly different dynamic than the military. But the military is a massive. Massive public relations entity, and right now is the time when you see it in its most clear form as we move up towards Remembrance Day, mm-hmm. and it's just a one after another of different military sponsored events that, you know.
Well, this is a celebration of war. It's not a celebration of the Armistice Day, originally called, or peace, or anything like that. This is a war celebration of what it's become today.
And if you look at it, you find that there's a lot. I don't know how many exactly, but probably into the hundreds, maybe even into the thousands of the different ceremonies, of the different events taking place across the country that are, you know, the military gives, or Veterans Affairs give $5,000, $10,000, $50,000 to organize these, or sometimes larger sums, to organize these events. So this is, you know, there's a popular component to it, but much of it is dependent upon the actual direct financial backing of the military. Mm-hmm. And the military spends hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars every year on promotion of its worldview. They have hundreds of employees that are full-time employees just to deal with public relations. The estimates are a little bit unclear, but from the lower end, around 300, and the higher end, around 650. They, you know, this is public money being spent on getting their perspective things out, in the case of Remembrance Day, they portray this as a fight for Canadian liberty, when in fact everyone who knows anything about World War I knows that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. World War I was a totally nonsensical, from the standpoint of human rights or democracy or whatever, battle. It was a battle between the dominant imperial powers, Britain and France, and the up-and-coming imperial power, and they were trying to carve up Africa and carve up other parts of the world. That was part of the backdrop to World War I, and Canada joined the war because it was part of the British Empire, and the British Empire was going to war, and huge numbers of Canadians, tens and tens of thousands of young Canadians were killed, and they killed many tens of thousands of young Germans, and you know, there's stories about the ecological damage in France today. They still take out huge amounts of unexploded ordnance from rivers and lakes around where their fighting was going on in France, and it's still it was a huge ecological no-go zone where people were not allowed to go in France, my reading of Canadian foreign policy is that there's only one war that Canada's been part of that you could make a case after the fact that it was a morally just thing, and that was World War II. Mm-hmm. So fighting in Sudan in the late 1800s, the Boer War of the late 1800s, early 1900s, World War I, Korea, first Iraq War in the early 90s, bombing former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, Syria today. None of that do I think those were justifiable after that. World War II, the motivation for Canada participating in World War II wasn't about fighting fascism or fighting anti-Semitism or fighting the Nazis. It was about fighting Nazis, but it was about fighting the Nazis because they were a threat to British
Mother England
power.
Well, and 100 years, Eve, after the war to end all wars, this is the anniversary year, of course, and there'll be much made that it's 100 years after the Great War, the war to end all wars, World War I. Much looks the same. It's like war has been a constant in between then and now, and it seems to be even more so on the horizon in the future. I wasn't being glib either, Eve. When the CBC doesn't question government policy, and it is an arm of government, and it's funded by government, not entirely, but primarily, I see them as merely a PR outfit. And when you see the way that the news is presented on the CBC television, especially these days, the way the reporters, guardedly, are coached to, you know, put more feeling into the way that they express the news, you know, how the newscasts, the newscasters of old would turn in their graves to see it today. I see it as nothing more than propaganda, base propaganda, really. Eve, as always, we have a lot more we can talk about than we have time to talk about it in. But before we go, you're doing a second event on Sunday, and it deals with Palestine. You know, I got an email from ceasefire.ca yesterday, and they were asking me to support their call to stop Canadian arms shipments to Saudi Arabia, a worthy cause. I wrote them a letter and said, yeah, I'll be happy to do that once you endorse stopping arms shipments to Israel. It's not a large number, but more than $10 million of arms went to Israel from Canada in 2017. Talk about your second event briefly, Eve, on Sunday. I don't have the wares of it in front of me, I don't believe, but...
Yes, the second event is going to deal with NDP Palestine policy, an issue that's of significant relevance here in Victoria, considering that two NDP MPs in the area are the main players in the Canada-Israel Interparliamentary Group, which is part of one of the main demands I think we need to make of the NDP with regards to Palestine, which is that those two MPs, Murray Rankin and Randall Garrison, remove themselves from that Israel lobby organization. But the talk... you can find details on my website at
evangel.com. Here it is, Eve. Sorry. Overcoming the NDP's Anti-Palestinian History, November 3rd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., UVic Cornet Building, B111. Eve will offer a roadmap for those who oppose racism and colonialism to push the NDP into supporting the struggle of the Palestinian people. So that's this Sunday, November 3rd. At UVic.
I believe that's actually Saturday.
Or Saturday, sorry. Propaganda, fake news, beware. Saturday, November 3rd, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. here at UVic in the Coronet Building. Well, Eve, of course, your website, too, your books are copiously listed there, eveangler.com. That's Y-V-E-S, angler.com. You can find out more about Eve's stuff. And again, to reiterate, though, Eve is tonight going to be right up here at the Hickman Building at 7 p.m. for his presentation on his new book, Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Thanks a lot, Eve, for coming on again and keeping us up to speed, eh?
Thanks a lot for having me. Okay.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Till the next time, eh? Now, I'm going to take a brief break, and when I come back, Janine will be here to bring us up to speed with some of the things going on this week, so do stick around.
Tonight, November 1st, Jessica Eisen presents a discussion titled Feminist Jurisprudence for Farmed Animals. The majority of animal advocates have been women, and feminist scholars have long drawn thematic and material connections between the exploitation of women and the exploitation of animals. But where does law and legal theory fit in this picture? This talk will explore some of the ways that feminist jurisprudence and feminist theory offer an innovative set of contributions to the study of animal law. Today, 12:30 till 1:20 p.m. at the Fraser Building Room 158. And also tonight, Chris is Eve Engler, often guest on your show. Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada is his latest book. He's examining the role played by Canada's political left over many decades and looking at the historical record of Canada's Social Democratic Party and unions in supporting imperialism from the creation of NATO, the Korean War, the Bay of Pigs invasion, the 2004 coup in Haiti, for some examples. Even though the left in Canada has not been politically critical, there is work to be done, and Eve suggests a role for the left in helping to create a more just foreign policy. So that's tonight. It's free at the Harry Hickman Room 105 at UVic. Also tonight at UVic, the Soviet Experience, a discussion group looking at the writings from Michael Parente, who perhaps challenges the idea of Russia, which is perceived as an impoverished, despotic, and tyrannical dictatorship. It's more complex than that. There's a whole history there. You can go and learn and talk about it tonight at 6 till 8 at the Student Union Building at the Sub at UVic. Tonight also, the Philippine Consulate in Vancouver is holding an emergency vigil for Sagay 9 on October 20th of this year. Apparently, farmers engaging in land cultivation in Sagay City were gunned down, brutally killing 9 and wounding 4 others, including women and children. So for more information and to say this is a crime and let's stop killing farmers, you can join the vigil tonight at 5:30 at 999 Canada Place in Vancouver. That's at the Philippine Consulate. On Friday, U.S.-Canada Hands Off Venezuela, a protest action in Vancouver with right-wing violence and imperialist attacks and sanctions increasing. It's now more important than ever that we as peace-loving people in the U.S. and Canada join with the people of Venezuela, unite to defend Venezuela's sovereignty and self-determination. So Friday, you can join a protest action at 4 at the U.S. Consulate, 1075 West Pender Street, and there's also a petition drive and info display 5:30 at the Art Gallery, on Friday, that is, from 4 till 7 altogether. Mawoween, the cultural evening of anti-war beats and treats. The mobilization against war and occupation formed on October 29th, 2003 to organize against the U.S. and U.K. occupation of Iraq. From then until today, Mawo continues to be a constant anti-war voice in Canada and internationally demanding an end to all imperialist wars and occupations, as well as self-determination for all oppressed nations. So they're having a little party. Friday night, 7:30 at the Old Crow Coffee Company, 655 Front Street in New Westminster. On Saturday, Hands Off Yemen anti-war rally opposed Canada's imperialist support of the U.S.-led Saudi war on Yemen. According to a UN report October 25th, half of Yemen's population is facing pre-famine conditions. 3 million Yemenis have been internally displaced. Many are in dire need of health care. but are unfortunately unable to receive it due to the sea, land, and air blockade placed on the country by Saudi Arabian warships since 2015, and tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians have been killed. So Saturday from 1 till 3, 1245 West Broadway in Vancouver, Hands Off Yemen Anti-War Rally. Eve Engler is back on Saturday with a talk called Overcoming the NDP's Anti-Palestinian History. Is it appropriate for NDP members of parliament to be working for, in quotes, greater friendship with a country that is killing and maiming thousands of non-violent protesters? So before Israel's creation, Canada's Social Democratic Party took a sensible humanist position towards Zionism, but soon began echoing Israel's justification for ethnically cleansing Palestinians and invading neighboring countries in 1956 through 1967. And there's discussion of politicians who have supported this. That might be surprising to some people. Eve Engler has looked at the history and offers a roadmap for those who oppose racism and colonialism to push the NDP into supporting the struggle of the Palestinian people. At Saturday, November 3rd, 1 till 3 at UVic, Cornell B111. International Cube Day in Victoria. The participation is at 1150 Douglas Street. Cube of Truth is a peaceful static demonstration akin to art performance. It operates in a structured manner that triggers curiosity and interest from the public, and the attempt is to lead bystanders to a vegan conclusion through a combination of local standard practice animal exploitation footage and conversations with a values-based sales approach. Saturday from 6 till 9 at 1150 Douglas Street. Monday, Food Not Bombs is having a movie night at Camus Books. The film is called Just Eat It. It's a 74-minute documentary about food waste and food rescue by Pegleg Films. Camus Books is at 2620 Quadra Street. The film is at 7 till 9. Tuesday, the Victoria Anarchist Reading Circle at Camus Books on Quadra Street. They will be beginning their circle by discussing Indigenous solidarity. If you want to look at the readings, they're online at Facebook, Victoria Anarchist Reading Circle. Marxism and Feminism on Wednesday, November 7th, a discussion on the struggle for women's liberation, 6 till 8:30 at the UVic Clara Hugh C111. And then finally, Chris, on November 7th and 8th, a two-spirit gathering that honors Indigenous worldview, open to all LGBTQ2S youth aged 12 to 24 and the allies who support them. Chance to meet and connect over 2 days of ceremony, workshop, keynote speakers, information booths, group activities, providing friends and family the opportunities to learn about this community in a safe and open environment. This is happening at the Victoria Native Friendship Center. They ask that you register at vnfc.ca. That's all I got for this week. Thanks, Chris.
Well, thank you, Janine. And I'm going to take another brief break. And when I come back, I'll talk to Jeb Sprague. We'll talk a little bit about his latest book on the Caribbean and globalization. Stick around for that.
Debajo de esas dos secas, years. Ellos me quieren mirar, pero si tú no los dejas, pero si tú no los dejas, ni siquiera parpadear. Besar tus labios quisiera, malagueña salerosa, y decir.
Isn't that great? That was from the band Brisas del Palmar. They're a Cuban band that were here in Victoria a number of years ago, and I picked up a disc at their show because they were so terrific, as you can hear, you know. But that's actually my homage to Mexico's Day of the Dead, which is tomorrow, of course. It is November already, believe it or not. And believe it or not, too, there's a glitch in the usually immaculate presentation of Guerrilla Radio. I haven't heard from Jeb Sprague. He's a little absent. So Janine mentioned, first of all, there is a change of schedule, or at least change of the information I gave you about Eve Engler's appearance here Saturday, November 3rd at UVic. I announced it was 11 to 1. It is actually 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. So then that, again, is Eve Engler, Overcoming the NDP's Anti-Palestinian History, November 3rd, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at UVic's Cornet Building, B111. And that's in the middle of the ring there. Eve Engler will offer a roadmap for those who oppose racism and colonialism to push the NDP into supporting the struggle of the Palestinian people. And again, Eve's going to be up here tonight speaking on his late, his just released book, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, at 7 p.m. in the Hickman Building. Janine mentioned during the events thing that there's a Michael Parente discussion presentation. Michael Parente is terrific. I really like this guy, and he's been on the show a number of times over the years. At my website, guerrilla-radio.com, you can go and see loads of my archive shows, and you'll find a bunch of stuff by Michael Parente appearing on this show. So in the absence of Jeb Sprague, I think I'm going to go way back into the very distant past to an interview that I aired with Michael Parente February 2nd, 2003. And maybe Sprague, Jeb will call, who knows.
Padre mío San Lázaro,
Chango Tejito de Obatala.
Padre mío San Lázaro,
Chango Tejito de Obatala.
Terrorism is something that's been practiced widely and massively by the U.S. national security state, by U.S. leaders for decades on end. State-sponsored terrorism has claimed any number of victims. So I think the September 11 events should be condemned as a two-dimensional, a twofold thing. One, the work of religious fanatics. And I do discuss in my book, The Terrorism Trap, the long tradition and relationship between religion and violence. But at the same time, we should also point out that all this violence takes place in a context of violence perpetrated by U.S. leaders in having successfully destroyed popular democratic movements in countries throughout the Middle East, not to mention Latin America, Africa, Asia, but throughout the Middle East, in Turkey, in Syria, in Iran and Iraq, country after country, U.S. power was used to destroy very legitimate democratic, economic democracy, political democracy aspirations that were arising in those countries. So what you have left now, the only outlet left, is this kind of religious totality, which now proclaims an apocalyptic encounter with the demon of the West.
Well, of course, this this religious fundamentalism isn't isolated, and it's not relegated only to Israel, say, and the Arab world. George Bush himself displays a huge dose of this Christian fundamentalism, whether he's talking about crusades or infinite justice or anything else. I mean, what aspect of this terrorism trap is the trap that the American public and the American Constitution are falling into?
Yeah, I discussed this in the book, how September 11 was a horrible tragedy for many of us, but for the ruling groups, it was a golden opportunity. And that's not my speculation. George Bush himself said, this may turn out to be a great opportunity, a great opportunity. And then he started talking about how we can move in and do this and do that and the other. And the first things he did was cut further cuts in human services here in the U.S., increased tax cuts to the very rich, the top 1%, massive increases in the military budget, and waging a war on our civil liberties, and trying to sling the label terrorism onto anybody who protests now. This is what we're seeing happening. People who protest, people who get into any kind of direct action. Some kid breaks a McDonald's store window in a fit of protest, and this is called the Terrorist Act. So they're trying to legitimate their murderous policies throughout the world, wrapping the flag, getting people to rally around the flag and wrapping the flag around the president, and his approval ratings have gone up, and people get frightened, they do rally around their president. And at the same time, he's trying to suppress any critics who have a different view.
Well, and of course, this isn't just the administration or George Bush or Ashcroft or Rumsfeld. Yeah, Bumsmell. It's not just those guys that are doing this. I mean, I was really interested to read in the book that the Wall Street Journal, like within hours of the towers coming down, they were spouting on about this exactly as Mr. Bush might have said, this unique political climate for whatever opportunity that presents for them.
To push a conservative agenda.
But that climate...
Very explicitly they said that. Now's his chance to really push a conservative agenda, you know, his policy.
Well, the climate isn't so unique when you... It may be for America, but not when you consider history in Nazi Germany or the Third World. Mm-hmm. I found in your book also you talk about bringing the Third World home to America. Can you describe a little bit what you mean by that?
I believe the goal of the ruling political economic elites in the United States and in most Western capitalist countries is to roll us back. It's true of Canada also, to roll us back to 1900. In 1900, you might recall, the United States and Canada and the Netherlands and Belgium and lots of other countries and France were third world countries. Well before the term, half a century before the term had been invented,
mm-hmm.
They had a high instance of child labor, high instances of poverty, high instances of typhoid, tuberculosis, and other diseases of poverty. There were almost no human services to speak of. There was almost no pensions to speak of, retirement plans or any of these things. No occupational safety protections, no minimum wages, no protections or guarantees for labor unions, or very few. So it took a century of struggle to gain whatever standard of living we have, as imperfect and inequitable as it is, as poorly distributed in our population as it is, those gains have been made. The goal is to get us back to being that third world, those third world people again. And they say it. They've always opposed any kind of gains we've made, every kind of gain that working people have made in these countries. Minimum wage, better salaries, all these other things, they oppose tooth and nail, and they're still opposing. They still oppose environmental protection regulations. They still oppose occupational safety laws. They still oppose minimum wage laws. They still oppose human services and pension funds and Social Security and all those things. They have never given up trying to get people back, to roll back democracy, roll back economic democracy, circumscribe political democracy, because when people use their political democracy to defend their standard of living, their economic democracy, then you try to limit and delegitimize their political democracy. And so this whole campaign against terrorism plays right into that.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to CFUV. This is Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Parente. His new book is called The Terrorism Trap, September 11 and Beyond. When you talk about, Dr. Parente, when you talk about rolling back democracy, taking us back to a time of Dickens or something of this effect, the Democratic Party has long been thought to be the protector of the poor, the savior of the little guy, if that's not putting too fine a point on it. You're quite critical in your book. You refer to them at one point as a gaggle of political wimps. What's going on with the Democratic Party right now, and especially today when George Bush is, I guess just a few minutes ago, finished addressing the nation on the need to go and bomb another impoverished country?
Well, the Democrats are trapped in their own cowardice and in their own opportunism. It's always the contradiction of the Whig. I call it the Whig syndrome. You know, the Whig party is not quite as perfectly confident of its infinite legitimacy. The Tory party is the king's instrument and the party of property and propriety. So the Whigs always have to kind of out-Tory the Tories in a way, to shuffle in there and show, oh, we're for God and King and country too. And when those symbols are raised, they collapse, not realizing that when they hurry to get behind the president, they're just strengthening him all the more, and they're just limiting their own political options all the more. Instead, what they should do is have an organized, forthright, outspoken opposition to these kinds of policies. But they don't. And another reason also is that most Democrats are financed by many of the same interests that finance the Republicans. So they're not going to go too far in opposing the giant oil interests and the military industrial lobby and the like.
Well, Dave, there's been a lot of talk in wherever it can leak through in the press down south there that the economy is in bad shape. It's sinking, and it's sinking fast. I mean, notwithstanding what's been going on Wall Street down there, but just everybody, Joe Blow American, they're hurting, and they have been hurting, especially since Mr. Bush took the White House. The Democrats have long been associated with a party that is, if not vaunted for being responsible for economic performance, at least for taking care of domestic issues, and yet they're refusing to pick up that ball and going with Bush on this wild escapade into Iraq. Now, where's the hope that the Senate isn't going to follow, that is dead divided, isn't going to follow where the House of Representatives have already gone?
Well, there isn't too much hope. I'm not holding my breath. What I am hoping is that they will take note of world opinion and even opinion here at home. Yesterday in San Francisco, we had 10,000 people in Union Plaza protesting against the U.S. going into a war. And we've had people all over the country. The day before that, there was 1.5 million in Italy, all through Italy in different cities, protesting against any bombing or attack of Iraq and calling for the lifting of the sanctions. So those things are beginning to impact on some of these representatives, but it doesn't look very good. I mean, one of the things that makes this whole terrorism war against Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan, and now Iraq, this idea of perpetual warfare, it creates this siege psychology, and it blows away the scandals, the corporate scandals that have been in the newspapers about Enron and WorldCom and Harkins and Halliburton, which directly implicate the president and the vice president of the United States in tax fraud, accounting fraud, and insider stock dumping before the stock collapses, before it's revealed that it's just a lot of paper, worthless paper, and they made millions on it. These two are directly implicated. Their families are implicated. These issues should be being exposed and discussed right now, and they've just been blown right off the front page, right off the TV, with all the war talk. So they just keep pursuing war. Now, the one hope is, of course, that the people come to a realization that they can wave their flag all day, but it doesn't feed their kids and it doesn't pay the rent. And that did happen in 1990-91,
yeah,
when George Bush Sr. Got a 93% approval rating in the country. Everybody thought he was a big hero going after Saddam Hussein and all. And then less than 10 months later, he lost re-election to Bill Clinton. You see, if you poll people on the particular issue, is the president really out there fighting hard? They'll say, yes, it's a big approval rating. But that doesn't mean they're not unhappy about a lot of other things. But what this war has done is it's take the Republican Party, which is just 2 months ago, a month ago, was the party of corporate scandal and recession, and now turn it, of course, into the party of military victory and defending America against yet another trumped-up evil. This was done also with the bombing of Iraq in 91. This was done with the destruction of Yugoslavia. In my book, To Kill a Nation, the attack on Yugoslavia, I point out how the Serbs were demonized, Milosevic was demonized, there were atrocities committed by all sides, and they were sporadic and varied.
I don't know what that was. But that was Michael Parente speaking on this show. What was that now? Again, February 2nd, 2003. Now, Michael, there's going to be a discussion on Michael's work coming up. If you want to check out, and that was on Janine's Left Coast Events bulletin, if you want to check that out, go to guerrilla-radio.com, and you can see postings of not only this show but all the Left Coast Events happenings up there as well. And I want to thank Eve Engler for coming on the show today. And I apologize because Jeb Sprague didn't show up. At least I'm sorry that he didn't show up. I don't have to apologize for him not phoning me. He does. But we'll see what happened there. I don't know. But again, his new book is just out, and he would have been happy to talk about it. Globalizing the Caribbean, Political Economy, Social Change, and the Transnational Capitalist Class. That's Jeb Sprague. You can find him online. And Eve, of course, again, to reiterate that his event tonight is at 7 p.m. in the Hickman Building up here at UVic. And on Saturday, he'll be at UVic again between 1 and 3 p.m. This time, he will be talking on a different topic, overcoming the NDP's anti-Palestinian history in the Cornet Building, B111. That's Saturday, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. That's all I've got for this week. But do stay tuned. There's more to come, as ever. But that's all I got. Till next time.
Y allí será.